Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is part two of what I consider to be the greatest Hollywood murder mystery of all time, complete with a cast of characters straight out of central casting. And I thoroughly enjoy this, and I cannot believe that somebody has not made more about the death of William Desmond Taylor than they have. Once again, I am joined on this journey through all these characters, and I have Jen with me. Jen, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Last week we stopped. We were talking about some of the suspects, and we were at Mabel Normand, and she was the last one we talked about, and like all many of the other suspects, she died an early death of tuberculosis in 1930. Why don't you just kind of recap how William Desmond Taylor died, and then we will move on to all of our suspects again.
Okay, so William Taylor Desmond was Hollywood film director, and he was discovered dead, lying in his living room with a gunshot wound to his back. And he was discovered by one of his employees.
Mr. Peavy, I believe, was the one that discovered him.
That is correct. Mr. Peavy.
The Mr. Peavy who died of syphilis-related dementia in 1931. It's amazing what people died of. I mean, we had, Mabel Normand dying of tuberculosis. We got Peavy dying of syphilis-related dementia. We talked about Mary Miles Minter, the child star turned teen screen idol who I think you and I were in agreement last time was probably sleeping with William. We think so.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And then she spent some time in a sanitarium. She did live to be, you know, a good old age. She died in 1984. So she was one of the only ones, if I feel like, when I look, that had some kind of natural life. I talked about the police detective in 1930 who wrote an article. And he was a detective who actually worked on the crime. He was not one of the original homicide flying five or whatever the heck they were called, homicide investigators. But he was asked shortly after that to start investigating, and he had a suspect that he is convinced is guilty to this day, and we'll talk about him in a second. One of the things that I mentioned briefly in part one is that this really captured the public's imagination, and there were books that were written about, there was a lot of articles, and each reporter from each one of these newspapers seemingly had their own favorite suspect. Most books have basically focused on seven people. I mean, that's how nobody's ever really been able to narrow it down beyond that. Now, you and I think both, and we have not discussed who we think did it, but I think that we're on the same page, and we'll get to that. But these seven or eight, and we've discussed some of them, but this police detective had one suspect in mind, and his name was Edward Sands. And are you of the opinion that it was Edward?
No, not so much, just because he goes on to disappear, and then we learn possibly why he disappeared.
And you talk about why he maybe had never been heard from again, but I will say this, that so the reason that he was on the list of suspects is he had prior convictions for embezzlement, for forgery. He had deserted from the military. He spoke in a fake kind of Cockney accent, you know, kind of much like Lindsay Lohan or something. And he had worked as Taylor's valet and cook until 7 months before the murder. And while Taylor was in Europe the summer before, Sands had forged Taylor's name on checks. He had wrecked his car. He then later burgled Taylor's bungalow. He left footprints on the film director's bed. But following the murder, he was never, ever heard from again. And this detective, like I said, is totally convinced that it was Edward Sands. Why don't you explain maybe why we never heard from him again?
Okay, so Edward Sands, he just takes off, and no one knows where he went, but the thing is that he's going to be sketchy because he starts mailing the director pawn shop tickets from where he had pawned the director's items. But the thing is that the tickets were coming back to the director, not in his stage name, you know, that we all knew him as William Taylor Desmond, but it's his real name. This is scary, as William Cunningham Dean Tanner. That is something that no one was supposed to know, much less use. And this Edward Sands is letting him know that he knew it.
This police detective says about Edward Sands, he said, and I'm quoting from this article that he wrote for True Detective Mysteries in 1930. And he says, almost from the very first hour of my investigations, I have known who committed this murder. Yet, at the present time, the evidence is so limited that were the guilty person to come forward and confess the murder, he would have to produce corroborative testimony before his confession could be accepted. He, and all these he's are in quotes, would be compelled to substantiate his confession by other credible testimony in order to prove his guilt and secure his own conviction. And he says, and that includes even Edward F. Sands, the one person who practically every investigator in Los Angeles believes was the slayer.
Don't you feel like he's kind of leading us that way, though, because of the DA's office? You know, the DA chose him to work that case, and there's a reason, because he knew possibly that he would go along with the plot, which was to turn everybody away from any Hollywood suspects. They wanted it to be a suspect that was, you know, outside of the realm of, you know, actors and actresses, anyone in the in crowd. And this guy, you know, he helps them push their agenda, because the DA is dating one of the suspects on this list.
Yes. And that, you know, and the DA did not recuse themselves, I don't think.
No, he didn't.
So this detective says, with this knowledge locked in my heart for the past 8 years, my position has forced me to carry on a nationwide investigation reaching from the Pacific to the Atlantic seaboard, from the racetracks of Agua Caliente to the frozen depths of the Alaskan goldfields, knowing full well that each new clue would lead me just where I expected it to lead, nowhere. So did he really go to all these places, I wonder?
Maybe in his mind. It sounds very scripted to me. The guy is scripted from the very beginning when you open his book, and he's like, oh, you know, you can bet the family jewels that I couldn't wait to work this case. He's extra.
You know, it just, I'm trying to find where he thinks that it was Edward Sands. Part of the problem was that, and this guy who, or person who created this Taylorology site, you know, says that the detective is relying too much on media reports. And as I said, you know, the media kind of each fixated on one person and made their narrative fit that person. And I'm just not convinced when I read it that and learn about it that it is Edward Sands. I mean, obviously he has this history, but he had not, as far as I know, I don't think he had actually ever murdered anybody. Most of his were white collar kind of crimes rather than assault and things like that.
Yeah, he's more like a cat burglar or someone that, you know, like you said, will crash your car, but not so much a murderer. It is sketchy about the name, but then when you think about that another suspect that ends up on this list that law enforcement has basically ruled out ends up being William Taylor Desmond's own brother, and he gets accused of being possibly Mr. Sands.
We talked about some suspects. I'd like to go back because I think it's important. I don't remember if I talked about Faith Cole McLean. I think I did, but she and her husband, he's an actor, Douglas McLean, and they were Taylor's neighbors. And Faith is, you know, assumed to have seen the killer because they were startled by a loud noise at 8 o'clock. And she went to her front door and saw someone emerging from Taylor's home, who she said was dressed like my idea of a motion picture burglar. And that the person paused for a moment before turning and walking back through the door as if having forgotten something. Then they reemerged, flashed a smile at her, before disappearing between the buildings. And then McLean decided she had heard a car backfire. And she also told police interviewers, and this is the part that's important, that the person looked funny, like movie actors in makeup, and may have been a woman disguised as a man. When I read this, it just totally kind of eliminates Edward Sands for me. And one of the reasons, the biggest, is that it doesn't fit with the whole actor kind of thing. Also, she would have known Edward Sands. She would have known what he looked like. She would have known his movements and things like that because they're neighbors. And Edward Sands had worked for Taylor up until 7 months previously and worked for him for quite some time. So I just think that she would have known if it was Edward Sands.
I do too. It sounds like it's a stranger and it sounds more like it's a female. And then also when you go back to what they said about the crime scene and the trajectory of the bullet and things like that, the person would need it to be probably no taller than 5 feet. I imagine Edward Sands was taller.
Yeah. And I just, and then smiling or whatever, this, it's kind of creepy.
That is creepy. If you look up and you see, you know, basically someone coming out of someone's home and they're dressed the way that they describe and they flash a smile at you. Almost as if they're, you know, they're happy with their work.
And, you know, I think that we can also assume that she would have known Mabel Normand. And it doesn't. So if we, if you want to go by the supposition that Mabel was walked out to out of the bungalow at 7:45 and then the limousine drove her away, I don't think she came back in, did that, and you know, dressed as, you know, she would have been dressed the same way that she had been dressed and wouldn't have had time to make herself a woman looking like a man.
Yeah, I don't think she had time to do that either. There just wasn't quick enough turnaround.
So let's, I don't want to talk about who I think it is, but there is somebody who actually confessed to murdering Taylor.
Gosh, there was a couple.
Yeah, well, the one I'm going to talk about, and then hopefully yours is different, but the was Margaret Gibson. And she was a film actress who had worked with Taylor back from the beginning when he had first come to Hollywood. And in 1917, she was indicted, tried, and then acquitted on charges that were basically equivalent to prostitution. Also, we have another drug dealer. She was apparently dealing in opium. And remember, we've already had cocaine, possible cocaine. You know, this is the whole where the studio kind of maybe was managing how they wanted this all to sound, because we've already talked about Mabel Normand and that perhaps that she had this cocaine addiction problem. But there's also nobody who, I guess, ever saw her do coke, and that it could have just been a fabrication from the studio when they're trying to manage who they wanted tried for the crime. So, but it's interesting that, you know, there's more drugs and that, again, William Desmond Taylor is involved with people that are doing drugs. She changed her professional name after that. And then in 1923, so a year after this, she was arrested and jailed on extortion charges. Now, when we talk about extortion, then it gets back to the whole, the police detectives thought that perhaps Taylor was being blackmailed because of those $2,500 checks made out to cash.
Right.
So, you know, obviously she was arrested and jailed on extortion charges, so it's something that she's familiar with, so maybe she was doing it also in 1922. However, the charges were dropped. No record of her name was ever mentioned in connection with the investigation. But soon after the murder, then all of a sudden she started getting work in a ton of films produced by famous players / Lasky, which was mafia controlled. And it was also Taylor's studio at the time of his death. So all of a sudden you've got somebody who really was having trouble getting work, has all this past history of the prostitution, the drug dealing, the extortion, not somebody you would normally typically hire, probably if you were a studio. But all of a sudden, she gets work with his studio. And then shortly before she died in 1964, she reportedly confessed to murdering him.
Yeah, her story's weird. You know, she had seen... She was this elderly old lady, and this guy was recanting the story about his neighbor that was this old lady, and she apparently hung out with his mom, and they were watching a television show, and a piece came on about William and his murder, and she flipped out and literally said that she killed him, and she thought everyone had forgotten about it. And then, you know, months later, or, you know, maybe a year later, she has a heart attack, and she had become a Roman Catholic, so she decided she wanted to confess, but there was no priest around to take her deathbed confession. So she goes on to tell the people that are around her, which again is her neighbors, that she killed the director.
Now, you mentioned somebody else who had confessed. Was there a different person?
There was a couple. I mean, there was a guy that was in the Detroit jail. His name was Harry Fields, and he said he was involved in a plot to kill Taylor, and he talked about driving assassins around looking for the director's home, and he said that it was for the director interfering with drug trafficking and something to do with him sitting on that board, and that will tie back to Mabel, you know, the story about him trying to get Mabel clean. Of course, Harry Fields' wife steps forward and says that he's crazy, and he's also an opium user, and he's just making things up. And then you had, did you look at the accountant?
No.
There is an accountant. Let me scroll down to him, because this suspect list is so long.
It is so long. I mean, one of the things when we do these, unless it's just some kind of, you know, a missing person or something, like Delphi or something, where there's just an unlimited number of people, right? In these Hollywood ones, there's generally a couple, and you're trying to choose between one or two. But there's so many people that have motives. And like I said, I think that us looking back at it 100 years later is that it was these newspaper reporters who spun these things to make it seem like there are 7 or 8 possible suspects, when really there should only be a couple.
Yeah, I wonder how many of these were made up. You have a point, because the way that they were spinning the media stories, some of these people might not be real.
One of the things when we talked about Mary Miles Minter last week is something I had forgotten to mention, was a couple of years before the death, Minter had what's referred to as a tantrum while locked in her room with her mother. Her mother's gun, and shots were fired. And then Minter played dead when the family came in, and then she jumped up and laughed. And there's one person who thinks that Minter is the one who did it, that she was maybe using the gun to get her way with Taylor, just as she tried to do with her family a couple years before. And in the rafters of the home where the family lived at the time of the fake suicide incident, was found an unfired soft nose lead bullet, which was the same type and weight as the fatal bullet, which was extracted from Taylor's body. And that's according to a detective in a 1937 grand jury testimony.
I don't find that too far-fetched, because she did have a thrill for the dramatics, and she was known to, you know, fake be hurt or fake be sick or, hey, fake be shot, anything to get his attention. And there was a story about how she might have had a last attempt at throwing herself at him, and he wasn't having any of it.
Yeah, you know, and you had mentioned that the district attorney was sleeping, a friend of, whatever, but he was sleeping with Minter's mother, Charlotte Shelby. And there is a rumor that Shelby may have paid off the district attorney, not only the first one, Woolwine. He was accused of bribery, by the way, I think in 1915. But then she also paid off a district attorney named Asa Keys, who was the district attorney after Woolwine. And he was also later convicted of bribery in another case. And then the next district attorney was a guy named Burren Fitz. And he was indicted in 1934 for bribery and perjury in another case. These are some wonderful district attorneys that Los Angeles had at the time.
Absolutely. How classy.
I know. And in the Shelby Minter family accounts, there were 700 and $50,000 that was never declared to the IRS. So we've already established that $78 that was found in his pocket when he died was worth about $1,100. So $750,000, I mean, you're talking millions upon millions upon millions of dollars in today's dollars. Just an astonishing amount of money. And what they did was they started transferring the money in 1922 to negotiable bonds and stock certificates with no written trail. And that's the accountant, right, Les Henry?
Yeah, and they were smart about it, too. They would say if they got caught, you know, if someone just, you know, accounting caught anything, they would just write it off as, oh, well, you know, she's just paying for security or, you know, just some type of protection. And it made it look like it was, you know, completely kosher.
Now, there's, I guess, Woolwine, or at least according to one author, Woolwine presumed that Mary Miles Minter was the one that did it. I do not. But, you know, that is one author's kind of thing. But what the author did to support it, which I thought was kind of interesting, was that Woolwine didn't believe women on a jury would ever find Mary Miles Minter, or any woman, guilty of murder, let alone sentence her to death. And Woolwine got tons of money from the studios during his campaign and after. And he was worried about his political future if he lost the conviction. And more than one police detective stated that every time they got close to solving the case, they were either told to lay off or you're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, in came the threats. And that's my point with Sands and him disappearing is the story goes is that he was found dead in a hotel room. Maybe someone in the DA's office or someone within the studio had him killed so that they would know where he was at all times, because if you're dead, you can't move. You can't go anywhere. So they carry you off and bury you somewhere, and then you can be their forever suspect and they can forever hunt you, because even after the manager from the hotel calls and says this guy's dead, they do continue to hunt Sands. He becomes their, you know, main person of interest because he's the one person that they know for a fact no one will ever find. And that leads them away from the Minters.
Yeah. You know, and like you said, Taylor had, you know, there was the phone calls and someone had been calling him late at night and then would hang up. And, you know, just to see if he was home, I guess. And then the night before Taylor's murder, he had shown his tax preparer, Marjorie Berger, $5,000 in cash that he kept, but the $5,000 was not found after his death.
Yeah, I still want to know what that's about. You know, I've looked everywhere and no one knows, but, you know, why did he pull that money out? Who was it meant for?
And is this, you know, two of the $2,500 checks to cash? I mean,
he was already running low on money. You know, his bank accounts were low when he died for someone that was making what he made.
I know he made a ton. And the Sands murder thing also is, you know, he signed in for work at a lumber yard in Oakland, California on the day of the murder.
So that guy was working. He wasn't even near the scene.
I know. And it's not like in today. I mean, we're talking 1922 to get from Oakland, California down to LA. It would have been tough. It would have been, and to do it before 8 PM, you know, presumably he worked all day. So let's say he even got off at 3 o'clock. You're not going to make it in 5 hours. You're not going to make it in 5 hours now.
There's no way. Yeah. He could not have pulled that off. There's no way.
So, you know, it just,
and also just the rare gun situation, the whole rare gun, rare bullets.
Yeah, that's not something that Sands would have had, just a normal gun.
Yeah, or a bat, or, you know, he was kind of hardcore. Kind of figure he would just, I don't know, probably stab the guy or, you know, slam him over the head with a bat. But these women, you know, they had fancy guns.
I know. So how do we think that Sands, because Sands was found dead of suicide in Connecticut, right? But how did he get all the way out there? Why was he out there?
And I read once that it was Connecticut, and then I read once it was San Diego. I'm torn because it's like 50-50.
Well, San Diego would make more sense because the district attorney, you know, knew that he had committed suicide, but kept it secret from the press. Because he wanted to throw suspicion away from suspects in the movie industry. So Woolwine then continued to manhunt for a guy that he knew was dead.
Exactly, because he needed to cover for what I think is, you know, the number one. I mean, when you look at the incidents surrounding the person I think did it.
Well, let's talk about her. Let's stop beating about the bush and let's talk about her.
Okay, well, to the bush. Okay, so incidents with the .38 revolver. Yeah, this Mary Minter's mom, Shelby.
Yes.
We
always say that we've found the worst stage mom ever.
Every week
we say that.
She has one now. Until I can top her, she's it. So she's the stage mom from hell, and she drove her daughter crazy. She would come to different movie sets and brandish weapons. She charged into a dressing room, brandished the .38. And I guess Monty Blue was an actor, and he was there, and she told him, I will blow your, you know, GD head off or your brains out. So she did that, and then Mary was caught having a sexual relationship with the director, James Kirkwood, and she got pregnant.
Yeah.
And her mom paid for an abortion, but she showed Kirkwood the .38 and said, you're not going to do that again.
There is a movie out there. It's a book. I'm sorry. It's called Cast of Killers. And it is based, it's written by a guy named, by Sidney Kirkpatrick. And it's based on research and interviews conducted by director King Vidor, who was fascinated with the Taylor case. And their theory, which I subscribe to fully, is that Charlotte Shelby, dressed as a man, slipped into Taylor's bungalow, found Mary there, and shot Taylor. I don't think that Mary was there.
But there was the blonde hairs found on his suit, and he was a meticulous man who would not walk around with blonde hairs on his suit.
But then why wouldn't Mabel have said that Mary was there?
Maybe Mary came in after Mabel left. Maybe Mary had been hiding there the whole time, either listening to him and Mabel talk or watching them. I don't think they were doing anything. They're probably talking. But if Mary was already in the house, then she was snooping. And if she wasn't in the house, she snuck in while he was walking Mabel out to her chauffeur.
Okay. So let's go with that. So Mary slips in. Okay. Now, remember, we have Mabel leaving at 7:45. We have the gunshot supposedly at 8:00.
Correct.
So was Charlotte waiting outside also?
If she was tailing her daughter and thought that she was going to see Taylor and she wanted to put an end to it, probably, because her daughter was her cash cow. You know, she didn't want her running off with another man, because if she ran off with another man, what would she take with her? Her money. And her mom couldn't have that.
So let's talk about I lost where I was. I dislike it. Okay. So I like your theory, but Mary would have already had to be there. I don't see her slipping in. But the other part that I have, here's something that perhaps would work if you want to say that there's two people in there. Is we have the report from the witness saying that somebody walked out, right? Then acted as if they forgot something, went back in, and then they came out again, flashed a smile. And that was the person that was supposedly dressed up, right? Well, what if the person, you know, witnesses, you know, can be kind of confused at sometimes. So what if the witness saw Mary leaving, okay, and kind of turned away for a second. And then when they came back, it was actually Charlotte coming out, flashing the smile. Was it the same person both times, or was it two different people?
I don't know. If they were both dressed up like, I don't know, Sherlock Holmes, then, I mean, I guess it could have been two different people, but would Mary have wanted him dead? She was kind of all over him, and if she was waiting for him at his home, I mean, she was blessed baby. So for all we know, if Mabel was there, I mean, she could have been upstairs just lying across his bed waiting on him. Yeah. And she was comfortable at this house, so.
Do we ever think that Charlotte and William were having a thing?
I don't think so. I looked at how people, they talked about that.
Yeah, and then Mary was the one that got jealous or something like that and then killed him because she was jealous that he was sleeping with Charlotte.
Yeah, I just don't see it.
I don't either, but I have seen that theory.
Yeah, I have seen the theory too, and I looked at it very closely. But Charlotte seemed to really dislike him. I think more than anything, she just wanted him gone.
In 1920, Charlotte did show up at Taylor's house late one night with her 1912 38 Smith & Wesson, tucked in the long sleeve of her gown, demanding to know whether Mary was there. And this was according to the testimony of Chauncey Eaton, her chauffeur, a perfect name for a chauffeur, Chauncey. But she was not there. So that was kind of fortunate for Taylor that night. So maybe she kind of showed 2 years earlier that she would be willing to go over there with her gun.
Yeah. And it goes on to say that, you know, that's when he became a little bit worried about this relationship that he was having with Mary, was that Mommy Dearest was getting scarier and scarier.
So in 2 years, I mean, so if Mary and Taylor are having this thing going on for 2 years, it kind of boggles the mind, I guess, that Charlotte didn't go over there in the 2 years between 1920 when she went over there with the gun, and then again not until 1922.
Maybe she thought that the girl would outgrow it, or I don't know, she would get different work and it would pull her away from him. But if they were spending a lot of time together, maybe he became a threat.
In 1937, Shelby was finally questioned in the Taylor case. So 15 years after the fact. And it was a result of a civil lawsuit between Shelby and her other daughter, Margaret, who testified, "I protected her against the Taylor murder case." And then this testimony from Margaret caused a grand jury inquiry where Fillmore stated that, so Margaret stated that Shelby was not home the night of the murder, and that Shelby was afraid Mary would run off with Taylor. And then Shelby insisted on this grand jury inquiry to clear her name after her daughter Margaret's accusation. So
yeah, because she had nothing to fear. She had the DA in her back pocket, so she could say likely whatever she wanted. But yeah, Margaret throws her under the bus. And it's funny because Mary, they ask her, you know, what do you think about the testimony with your mom? Do you think that she would have murdered Taylor? Did she want to murder him? And she said, I mean, you know, mom said once, I'll kill him, I'll kill him. She was like that. She was always going to kill somebody.
Yeah. I mean, she's pulling out that gun all the time. And, you know, we have this, like you said, the DA wasn't going to do anything because there's a successive number of DAs who have been taking her money. And we know that she has a lot of it. I mean, they probably had the equivalent of about $15 million or something just in the bank account that they hadn't reported to the IRS. It doesn't even matter how much other money that they had reported to the IRS. So she could definitely afford to bribe district attorneys. And her alibi for the night of the murder was an actor named Carl Stockdale, who basically it's been alleged that he accepted a lifetime income for saying that he was with Shelby between 7:30 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. Charlotte did, this is a fact, pay Carl Stockdale $200 a month for life.
Yeah, he got a lifetime payout for being her alibi. That's why I look at her and I think that she pretty much fits the bill. She has the gun, she has the bullets, she has all the right connections, and she wasn't home, and she had the motive.
And, you know, $200 a month doesn't sound like a lot, but again, if you multiply it out, it's about $3,000 a month in today's dollars for life. So, I mean, that's not bad for saying, hey, she was with me for between 7:30 and 9:30, and, you know, he's getting, in today's dollars, you know, 30 to 40 grand a year, every year for the rest of his life for doing nothing. So Shelby's mother and then that would be Mary's grandmother, Julia Miles, is apparently, well, let's talk about this gun. The gun fires these fancy bullets. And Julia, the grandmother, is said to have taken the revolver and thrown it in a bayou near her plantation in Louisiana in August 1922. In Cast of Killers, an interview between Detective Lieutenant Sanderson and the director, King Vidor, reveals that the gun was later retrieved from the bayou. And in 1973, former District Attorney Byron Fitz, one of the ones that was taking the bribe money and had was convicted of it or something like that, of different bribes, killed himself with an identical 38 Smith & Wesson revolver, which hasn't been seen since.
Yeah, so this gun, it gets thrown in a bayou, it gets fished out, and it surfaces again in the suicide of a DA, and then mysteriously vanishes. This gun has got around.
It did. And, I mean, Charlotte was just greedy. And the other thing that is that she and her daughter, Mary, were always arguing about money. And they had financial disputes. There was lawsuits. And I guess Shelby did initially talk to the police about the murder, but they're characterized as evasive and obviously filled with lies about her daughter's relationship with Taylor and other matters.
Well, yeah, and this DA Fitz guy, he went on to request that all of the remaining case evidence and files be turned over to him and that it stay with him on a permanent basis. And then those case files go on to disappear completely. In fact, Taylor's entire file disappears.
Yeah, I guess in 2007, they found a few documents that were made public, but there's...
You had to imagine that file, it should have been phone book thick with all these different suspects, and, you know, so much of it is gone.
Now, Shelby has this rare 38 caliber pistol and some unusual bullets, and these bullets were basically exactly the kind that killed Taylor. And that's what made her throw the gun into the bayou, is because it was so unique. And, you know, throwing a gun into the bayou, you know, whether it's her or her mother, I mean, this kind of nails it closed for me. And I don't understand. I mean, I guess it's the detective because he did work for the district attorney. And if you're thinking about the article in 1930 that he wrote, which is 8 years after the case, but remember in 1937, she's still bribing district attorneys. So in 1930, this still would have been in the thick of it, and this detective would have been working for the district attorney, and he is going to keep espousing the theory that Sands was the killer.
Well, yeah, because they had the movie studio that was given the money to, you know, lay back, and then she's given them money to lay back. They didn't want to cut off their, you know, nice money train.
And Charlotte spent a lot of time outside the U.S., in an effort to avoid, you know, inquiries about the murder and also to avoid any kind of press coverage related to the murder. It's interesting that, so the other daughter, Margaret, she was an actress also. And in 1937, 1938, she was suffering from clinical depression. She was an alcoholic. And Charlotte was, I would say that she was the suspect that was most often named by the writers, but the problem was that there was a lot of competing ones too. But she was, I would say she was in the majority. She was everybody's number one suspect.
Yeah, I mean, deductive reasoning, if you're not on someone's payroll, I mean, I don't know how anyone does not come back to her every time because she just checks every box.
And then what you had Byron, you know, who had taken everything. And then he said that he had concluded that the evidence was insufficient for an indictment and recommended that the remaining evidence and case files be retained on a permanent basis. Yes. And like I said, they all disappeared. and then Shelby died in 1957. So, you know, we are left with the wondering. I'm convinced that she did it. I think that she went alone. I didn't know what you're saying about the blonde hair, but I think that Mary was probably over there a lot. And, you know, Taylor could have just been sitting in a chair that Mary had been in and didn't know that he had the blonde hair on him.
Or Charlotte could have had, you know, the hair on her. It was her daughter. She was around her.
Yeah,
and maybe
exactly.
She rubbed against him and it transferred.
Because I just think that, what's her face, Faith McLean, it was a pretty specific statement. And I don't think that she would have missed a second person. And I don't think that Mary could have snuck out without Faith seeing her. So I think it was just Charlotte. And Charlotte definitely would have had access to looking like an actress or using actor things and, you know, would have picked up a couple of things. And also is the kind of person who would smile after killing somebody.
Yeah, I could see her doing that, giving that little smirk that she's just so smug and, you know, very comfy there. And she wasn't worried about anyone walking up on her.
What do we think, you know, the motive is?
Not running off with a daughter.
Yeah.
Maybe Mary was, maybe in her mind, in Charlotte's mind, Mary was getting too close to him. And she feared that either, I don't know, the girl would get pregnant again and then run off with him. To her, money was the motive. And she just didn't want Mary to run off and not give her money.
I think that Mary, that probably Charlotte, being the nosy person that she was, saw Mary's letters or something like that. And maybe concluded that it was something more serious than I think that William Desmond Taylor thought it was.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't see him running off with, you know, the young girl. If anything, you know, he was just playing with her. But maybe the mom picked up an older letter and, you know, read more into it than she should have. She was all about just protecting her investment and making sure that her daughter stayed on track. And any guy that, you know, tried to derail her was a threat.
And I think that maybe she found something, like you said, an old letter, maybe thought it was new, and just went over there and decided to kill him so that way, you know, she could keep the daughter for herself.
Yeah, that's what I always come back to.
Oh, I love this case. I'm glad that it was two parts. I'm glad that we could take our time on it and really just kind of enjoy it. I wish we had the file. I wish we knew where it was. I'm guessing that Fitz probably destroyed it all at some point. You know, when he committed suicide in 73, I'm fairly sure people probably were hoping that they could find the documents in his possessions or something. You know, it's always possible that it will show up somewhere, that it was just moved to a different area, or maybe there's some kind of secret file somewhere that the district attorneys of Los Angeles have. I don't know. But I'm hoping that someday it will come so we could see it, because I think that it would just be too great to relive it. And, you know, if people could see those files and then just, you know, do what I had envisioned, where you have like this turn into a big murder mystery play kind of thing.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Well, Jen, thank you once again. You can find Jen on patreon.com/JenDocumented, Twitter, Mascara and Mace, and everywhere in between, doing what she does best, talking about true crime. So, Jen, once again, thank you, and I look forward to next week.
All right. I'll see you next week. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Bye.